Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Catherine Peters, a neurologist and neuro-oncologist at the Preston Robert Tisch Brain Tumor Center at Duke University, who discussed a new analysis of the INDIGO study, a trial of vorasidenib in patients with IDH1-2 diffuse gliomas. The conversation, which took place at the 2024 AAN annual meeting, covers the observed impacts of the drug on patients' quality of life, neurocognition, and seizure control. Peters gave comment on the mechanism of action of the drug, how these data add to the previously published findings, and the next steps in research. Let's dive in.
Vorasidenib is a IDH 1-2 mutant inhibitor, and IDH stands for isocitrate dehydrogenase. It is a enzyme of the Krebs cycle, and when it's mutated, it actually produces a chemical called 2-hydroxyglutarate. And 2-hydroxyglutarate actually drives the development of brain tumors, and particularly low-grade glioma, which are a type of tumor that affects roughly, I'd say a third of people with glioma tumors, which is the most common malignant tumor in primary brain tumor patients.
So talk a little bit about the specific analysis that you're presenting here at AAN on the INDIGO study. What are some, just give a little bit of an overview and some of the greatest takeaways for our clinical community.
So the INDIGO study was designed to enroll newly diagnosed low-grade glioma patients that harbored the IDH1 or 2 mutation. These patients had to only have had surgery and could not have had other therapies, because one of the questions we were answering is, could we use this drug to sort of delay the use of other therapies that can cause severe neurotoxicity like cranial radiation? We enrolled 331 patients, and patients were randomized in a one-to-one fashion to either vorasidenib or placebo. If they did fail placebo, they were able to cross over to the vorasidenib arm. The primary objective was progression-free survival as determined by MRI imaging. So patients actually had to have growing tumor or a large enough tumor to evaluate to go into the study. And the key secondary endpoint was time to next intervention. And why this is important is we wanted to try to delay the time to that next intervention, which could be chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery. The endpoints that I presented were particular to the other secondary endpoints, which was patients' health-reported quality of life, and also their neurocognition was an exploratory endpoint, and the frequency of seizures, because unfortunately patients with these types of tumors are more apt to have seizures. We did publish in the New England Journal of Medicine the primary endpoint and the key secondary endpoint, which were progression-free survival and time to next intervention, respectively. Those were significantly positive, such that the progression-free survival for patients on vorasidenib was 27.7 months versus 11.1 months in the patients on the placebo. And the time to next intervention, we haven't even reached our median value for the vorasidenib arm, and it's 17.7 months for the placebo arm. So really we're honing in on these results about the patient experience, what's happening with their quality of life, what's happening with their neurocognition, and also what's happening with seizures.
How does this data, in your opinion, sort of build upon what we previously mentioned, as you previously mentioned, with the primary and secondary endpoints? Just talk a little bit about the significance of what the results you're sharing here are today.
So really the significance of it is that we used to use the tools to treat these patients like we treated high-grade gliomas. We'd give them radiation, we give them chemo, and the median age for these patients is around 40 years. And so this could cause very significant quality of life impairment and cognitive impairment. And what we were able to show is when we measured quality of life in these patients, we did not cause any detriment to their quality of life. And there was really no change over time in their quality of life in both the vorasidenib and the placebo group. So We did enroll a very functional group of patients, but we weren't hurting them. And now we have the opportunity to give this drug and extend not only their life that we know from what has already been published, but also to maintain their quality of life. And next, we also showed that we did not interfere with neurocognition, that it stayed stable throughout. And then finally, with seizure frequency, as measured by patient-reported diaries and also the number of anti-seizure medicines they were on, we did not cause any increase in seizures, and we did not lead to any escalation in anti-seizure medicines. So these patients on this drug really do have an opportunity to maintain their quality of life, their cognition, and control their seizures.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Peters to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on May 16th, the FDA issued an update to the labeling of glatimir acetate injection products with a new warning label that highlights cross-compatibility issues with the use of auto-injectors. In the update, the agency also alerted patients and healthcare professionals that some specific glatimir acetate injection therapies may be administered using an optional compatible auto-injector, while other glatimir acetate injection products must only be injected using the pre-filled syringe. Days later, Ionis and Biogen announced top-line results from the Phase 1-2 ALS INSPIRE trial showing that BIIB-105, an investigational agent in development for ALS, did not result in the desired reduction in neurofilament light and impact on clinical outcomes. Despite reaching target engagement in reducing expression of ataxin 2 protein, the companies have decided to terminate the development of the therapy, which acts as an antisense oligonucleotide. Additional analyses from the study assessing the ASO's impact on underlying disease process of ALS are expected at the upcoming European Network to Cure ALS or ENCALS meeting in Stockholm, Sweden in June. And finally, on May 25th, the European Commission decided not to adopt the Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use's negative opinion of Adalurin, a protein restoration therapy, and thus the medication will remain on market. The European Commission asked the CHMP to further consider the totality of evidence of the therapy, which was conditionally approved in Europe in 2014. The committee's negative opinion, issued in January of this year, came months after the group refused to convert Adalurin's conditional marketing authorization. In the latest update, the EU decided to refuse this opinion, factoring in data from patient registries and real-world evidence. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Peters.
This is obviously a phase 3 study. This is sort of a post hoc, I guess, per se, analysis a little bit. But what is sort of next for this drug and for the study? Have you had any conversations with your clinicians and colleagues about what to do next?
Oh, we're pretty excited about this. I mean, our patients, the study is still very active because even though we met our primary endpoint, our patients are still on study. They're still taking the drug. We're looking hopefully towards hopefully an FDA approval of the agent for our patients. The next is that the study was designed in a very particular population where they were very functional. They had a Karnofsky performance scale of 80 or greater, and they could not have seizures that were uncontrolled. They were interfering with their activities of daily living, and they couldn't have failed like 3 anti-seizure regimens. So there needs to be more done looking at those patients that may be having neurologic challenges that precluded them from the study. The next is we also looked for patients that had to have measurable non-enhancing disease, but we didn't look at patients that had a gross total resection and maybe didn't have any disease remaining, or on the flip side, had enhancing disease, which can be a harbinger of a more aggressive type of tumor. So we started with a very particular population. Now we need to answer the question for all those other populations with patients that have these mutations. The other thing about this medicine, and I think this is always important to note, it's oral, it's brain penetrant, and it is extremely well tolerated. So it can be taken for an extended period of time, but we don't know how long. So is this going to become a chronic medicine for our patients? And what are the quality of life implications? What are the financial implications? What are the fertility implications for those, given that they're in that decade of life where there's a lot of changes going on and a lot of, you know, life experience that we're hoping to provide for their patients to the best of their ability.
For just this patient population in general, with those with gliomas, diffuse gliomas, you know, what are some of the major unmet needs and, you know, outside of drug development per se, what else can we be doing for this patient population going forward?
We need to support them through the whole part of their disease. We need to not look just at the tumor. We need to look at the patient. Like, what's going on with their patient experience? You know, what's happening with their neurocognition? What's happening to seizures? Are they able to work? Are they able to function? What are the fertility implications? I think this is highly important. And asking patients, what do they want to learn? How do they want to grow and thrive? So I do quality of life research. And quality of life is about the being, who you are, the belonging, who you are with, and the sphere. And that can be the caregiver question. And the next is becoming, and what is the future? And I hope the future is that we can make this into a chronic condition that we can treat long term, and that they can, I would love to reach for the cure, but as we can limit morbidity, I would greatly love for that to happen.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.